Life Management Science Labs would like to acknowledge that we live and produce this podcast on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. We'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands of our listeners and our international colleagues. We'd like to pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Bouncing Back, the Personal Resilience Science Insights podcast produced by LMSL, the Life Management Science Labs. We are champions of life management science, providing structured insights informed by science and inspired by practice on key aspects of conscious living. Each week, we bring you scientific and practical insights on each element with the expert knowledge of professionals in the field. I am your host, Joanna. Let's get started. Hi, everyone. I'm your host, Joanna, and welcome back to another episode of Bouncing Back, where we talk about everything resilience on this podcast. So for today's topic, we're going to be shifting gears and talking about cognitive impairment and the signs of early dementia, but more importantly, kind of developing awareness about forgetfulness and exploring what systems are in place to support neurocognitive disorders as well. It's often something that doesn't get talked about enough, so I hope we can cultivate a safe space to get to know more about this today. And to do that, I'll be joined by Professor Li-Fei Low. Li-Fei is a professor in aging and health at the University of Sydney. She is a registered psychologist with a PhD in psychiatric epidemiology. Oh my gosh, that was a mouthful. But she also conducts research that she hopes will help make a difference in the world. And she has authored over 150 peer-reviewed articles and 3 books on dementia. So we're in great hands today. Hi, Li-Fei, how are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having me. I'm very excited to talk about mild cognitive impairment and dementia.
Yeah, of course. I'm super excited to talk about today's topic too, because I don't think I've actually properly had a chance to ever converse with someone on this topic. And I feel like it's really important to be able to do so. So firstly, I'd love to ask if you could please introduce yourself with a bit more about who you are and what it is you do.
So I work at the University of Sydney, and I'm a dementia, aging and aged care researcher. My first degree was in psychology, and at first I was going to be a clinical psychologist, but then I started working in a team that was doing research around dementia, and I realized how interesting it was. So I went and did a PhD in psychiatric epidemiology, as you said, which is trying to count how many people have dementia and look at risk factors related to dementia. And now most of my work is looking at public information about dementia and how we can intervene to improve the lives of people with dementia.
Amazing. And I know you've got over 150 peer-reviewed articles, and that's massive. Can you talk to me about what your process is like, especially regarding like the research for those?
I think that when you start off as a novice researcher or baby researcher, you think that what's important is that you do all the research very properly and you publish your findings, because in academia, it seems to be important to publish. But as I've had more experience, I feel like my current process for research is to listen for problems in the world. So I can see on the agenda that you've got a few questions about mild cognitive impairment, which is a syndrome that's emerged, I guess, that people don't talk about very much. And so there's a bunch of problems around mild cognitive impairment. Like, if you get a diagnosis, what does it mean? What treatments are available, in the public system for people with MCI or mild cognitive impairment? So a lot of the research now that we do is around kind of problems that we observe in the system or that people tell us about, and we're interested in trying to solve those problems or make the world a better place for people with dementia and older people as well and their carers.
Amazing. Thank you for sharing that with us. And how did you know that you wanted to sort of shift from, psychology over to this? Was it just something that clicked in you, or did you just decide to totally shift gears?
I mean, I was going to be a clinical psychologist because that's also about, making lives better, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I think I apply a lot of psychological theories and principles as part of being a researcher. But rather than working directly one-on-one with clients, if you think of it that way, what I do now is I still talk to them. I do interventions with them, but the purpose, I guess, is to generate generalizable knowledge that can be applied for more people.
Beautiful. Thank you for that. And we'll now jump into a little section that we call Have You Met Lee Faye? So we're just going to get to know you a bit more with some like fun little personal questions. So my first one for you is, are you reading anything at the moment or have any interesting book recommendations?
Well, right now I'm reading one of the Brandon Sanderson books. I don't know if anyone's familiar with Brandon Sanderson. So he's a urban sci-fi fantasy author. And during COVID, he kickstarted the most highly funded Kickstarter. So I'm paying Brandon Sanderson directly to read one of his books, which is quite fun, I think.
And what's the book about?
I've just started. It's about a painter, but I haven't got very far into it. I only just started reading it. So a painter in a kind of alternate fantasy landscape.
Oh, okay. So is this fictional or non-fictional?
Yeah, it's fiction.
Okay, fiction. Beautiful. That sounds really fun. Yeah. And my next one for you is about movies. Are you a big movie fan? Anything you're watching at the moment?
I gotta say, I really like reality television. So if you ask me what TV I'm watching, I'm probably watching reality TV of the kind of gaming variety. So I like Survivor. I've been liking the Traitors seasons. I'll even watch like Amazing Race. And I've been particularly liking, for those who like gaming shows, The Devil's Plan on Netflix, which is a Korean kind of game show. But instead of physical challenges, the challenges are all mental.
Oh, okay. I think that's actually come up on my recommended before. So I might give that one a go. Have you heard of The Chase? I believe that's what it's called.
Yeah, I haven't watched that yet.
Oh, okay. It's a good one to watch. Definitely a good like game sort of reality type of show. So recommend that one too. Beautiful. And I'd love to ask you if you listen to podcasts at all.
So I listen to quite a few podcasts. I listen to news podcasts, which is a bit boring. I will listen to reality show kind of recaps and rankings. And I also listen to the Reality Escape Pod, which is a podcast about escape rooms and immersive gaming experiences.
Ooh, that's super fun. Have you done an escape room yourself?
I've played lots of escape rooms.
Oh, are you like a fan of those like horror ones? I've only done like one before, and I believe it was like the Annabelle escape room or something like that. It was a horror-based one.
If I'm desperate to play an escape room, then I will play a horror game. They're not my favorite genre because they're very screamy. And so we started to do anticipatory screaming, where if you thought something scary was going to happen, you would scream before it happened.
Yeah, no, that's definitely fair. I love horror, but I get scared so easily. So there were definitely a lot of jump scares when I did that escape room. What was the most recent one you've done?
The last room we played was Forest of Echoes by Next Level Escape, which is a new escape room in Sydney CBD. Very highly recommended. It's full of story and not scary at all.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I feel like there are some really great, like, complex kind of escape rooms that really, you know, have a proper narrative to them, and I'd love to try one of those. So yeah, awesome. Thank you for that one. And lastly, I'd love to ask if you have a famous role model or even just someone in your life that you find inspirational.
Professor Henry Bridati was the oldest psychiatrist who gave me my first job in research, and I suppose he's been my role model. I don't think he's particularly famous unless you're a dementia researcher, but I've always respected him because not only is he a great clinician and researcher, but he's very kind to people, and he really has, I guess, looked after the dementia research community, and kind of tried to build everyone up.
Yeah, that's really lovely. Thank you for sharing those ones with us. I feel like sometimes you don't always have to have a super famous role model that everyone looks up to. It can just be someone that's like touched your life in a different way or could have contributed to your journey to get to where you are today. So that's really nice. I think we can jump straight into our interview questions now. So my first one for you is, why do you personally think that resilience is important in our lives?
There are a lot of things in our lives that we can't control. And I think that resilience is important because that's how we react, we respond, we bounce back from unexpected things that perhaps make life more difficult for us.
Yeah, for sure. And do you think that being resilient means being like immune to different adversity and like sort of stress in your life?
I mean, for me, it's not being immune in that. It doesn't mean that the stress doesn't affect you. It means that even though you're stressed, that you can recover from that stress, or that you have strategies or, you know, ways to overcome that, to, yeah, I guess, you know, get used to it or habituate it or manage it.
Yeah, definitely. And do you think that these sort of tools that you need in order to do this, sort of manage the stress, is something that people just naturally have? Or do you think that it often requires people to, you know, build them up over time?
I think that there are a lot of factors that help people be resilient. I mean, some are socioeconomic, right? So if you have money, if you crash your car and you've got plenty of money, then you can fix the car or buy a new car. Some are social in that, like you said, if you crash your car, if you've got a network of friends, someone, one of whom could fix your car or can do a, you know, a cheap deal for having your car fixed, that's a way of fixing your car. And another way is, I guess, having the skills yourself to be able to fix that car. So I think that some people might naturally have some skills, but a lot of them can be learned, but some of them come because of, you know, environment and luck as well.
Yeah, and I think you bring up a really good point as well, because I feel like sometimes in life, different people, depending on like their socioeconomic background, need to be more resilient than other people. Because, for example, you do crash your car, if you are more financially well off or you're well connected, it's easier for you to bounce back in those situations. But then, for example, if you're not and you struggle in those times, you're going to need a lot of resilience in order to come back from that and be just as strong as you were before.
Absolutely. And if you live in a city, perhaps you could live without a car for 12 months where you save up, because public transport's great. But if you live in a regional area, then you really might not be able to manage without a car. So that's also one, you know, one way of resilience, right? You might not be able to go to work if you lived in the country without the car.
Yeah, exactly. 100%. And I'd love to shift this over to talking about mild cognitive impairment now. So would you be able to give us like a brief definition of what it is and sort of what it looks like?
Of course. So let's start with the idea that as we all grow older, that our memory and thinking decreases slightly with age. But, you know, and mild cognitive impairment is when that decrease is perhaps faster or more than you would expect with age. I guess often mild cognitive impairment, the distinction is made between mild cognitive impairment and dementia, in that in dementia you have memory, thinking and other, you know, problems, but they interfere with activities of daily living, so your ability to pay bills or manage your doctor's appointments. Whereas mild cognitive impairment, you might have some memory and thinking difficulties, but they're not interfering with your life to that extent. And as we talked about resilience, it might be that people with mild cognitive impairment have some, they call it cognitive reserve or resilience, so that they might be able to manage their memory and thinking difficulties better, so that it doesn't interfere with daily life.
Yeah, and is that different to dementia, or are they connected?
Great question. So between normal age, so if you think, I'm going to make my hands now. So if you think this is the slope of cognition with normal aging, right?
Yeah.
And then this is what happens in dementia, this one, right? Like in between those two slopes is this area, and that's mild cognitive impairment. When people might have some difficulties, but it's not normal but it's not dementia. The tricky thing is, right, that if you have mild cognitive impairment, so if you're between this, you know, getting worse very slightly and getting worse very fast line, right, like some people, like you're at higher risk of getting dementia, but not everyone gets dementia. So people with mild cognitive impairments, I think it's a prime time, I guess, in older people to put in some risk reduction and try and, you know, delay or prevent getting worse, if that makes sense, and getting dementia. And not everyone with mild cognitive impairment will go on to get dementia. And some of people improve because maybe your mild cognitive impairment is because of a physical illness, or it could be because of, you know, depression. That's why your memory, thinking, your cognition has decreased.
And is it harder to diagnose mild cognitive impairment because it's in that in between?
Yeah, I think it's if you look at the strict definitions of mild cognitive impairment, so the research definitions, there's quite an extensive criteria that you have to meet. And so I'm a psychologist, so you would need some neuropsychological testing to like really meet strict research criteria for mild cognitive impairment. But clinically, you might see clinicians or geriatricians or even GPs talking about mild cognitive impairment in a some like kind of referring to this gray stage, but not meeting those strict diagnostic criteria. So right. It's I think it's because it's kind of this new syndrome that's emerged, if that makes sense. It's very messy still, and I'm sure that at some stage we'll have better names and definitions. But right now it's a bit messy, and some people will call mild cognitive impairment and it'll be one thing, and some people call it mild cognitive impairment, but it'll be slightly different.
Yeah. And does that impact how people are diagnosed? Could they be misdiagnosed due to the sort of lack of clarity that exists?
I mean, they could be misdiagnosed for all kinds of reasons. You can get a diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment, but it's not a disease, if that makes sense. It's a syndrome. It's a cluster of symptoms. So the issue with mild cognitive impairment really is how prognostic is it of getting dementia? Is this diagnosis, because the diagnosis itself is not really helpful to you unless you can get treatments and, you know, do risk reduction or are given strategies to help you manage your memory and thinking. If not, it's just a label, and potentially a label that increases your risk of getting dementia. So I think getting a diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment is only really helpful if it helps you get treatment, supports and services.
Okay, great. And is it really crucial, do you think, to sort of understand the distinctions between dementia and mild cognitive impairment?
I think that if you ask someone who had dementia or someone who had mild cognitive impairment, they would say that it's really crucial for them, like for how they feel about themselves, to know which thing they have. Because if you have mild cognitive impairment, that prognostically, that means you might get dementia, but it means you might get better, and or you might just stay the same for a long time. Whereas if you have a diagnosis of dementia, essentially we think that you're going to decline, and you know, if you eventually you'll die from the brain degeneration. So in terms of what it means for your health going forward, they're very, very different.
Yeah. And what are some of the main sort of symptoms of mild cognitive impairment? Like, obviously we've heard of memory loss, but are there any other symptoms?
Yeah. So besides memory difficulties, often what we see are difficulties with executive function or basically problem solving and planning. So it might be that you could still manage day to day, but you have trouble managing your tax. It might be that you could go on a family holiday, but you can't plan a very complicated trip, you know, with flights and buses and accommodation and, you know, tours and stuff anymore. So it's the more complex thinking that people have trouble with, as well as with memory.
Yeah. And do you think there are any sort of lifestyle factors, you know, like diet or exercise or like social engagement that kind of might play a role in delaying or mitigating the sort of progression of this?
Yeah. So there's quite a few studies now kind of showing that those lifestyle factors that you mentioned, so physical exercise, diet, the Mediterranean diet in particular is found to be helpful. So staying cognitively active as well as socially engaged, all like especially together can be protective against progression to dementia. I guess it's also important to mention in this context that physical health is also part of it. So you want to look after your heart health, you want to manage other chronic conditions, because if you think that mild cognitive impairment might mean that your brain is not working very well, which might be because of brain damage or because it's not functioning well, then you want to protect your brain or kind of look after your brain as best you can, because you don't want it to get even more damaged so that it becomes dementia.
Yeah. And is this something that is hereditary, or is it something you can develop, or is it something that can come about because of a lack of taking care of those different lifestyle factors like diet and exercise and all that?
Well, so we think that let me start like this. Because we started talking about resilience, right? So if we think of brain health as like when you're born and you grow all your neurons and education, that's like making your brain resilient. You know, it's growing more connections and making your brain healthier. And then through life, we damage our brain. So you might have a head injury, or which damages your brain, you know, and you know how they're talking about concussions and brain health and athletes and stuff. So they're all types of brain damage. You might have other types of brain damage, which might happen through mini strokes or not enough oxygen to your brain. So your brain kind of gets damaged through life as well. And it's particularly in older, and then there's different diseases. So Alzheimer's disease or Lewy body disease, they're all diseases that can affect your brain as well. So when you end up with mild cognitive impairment or dementia, it's because you've accumulated all this damage in your brain, if that makes sense. And you're no longer, and the remaining brain is not enough, has not got enough resilience now to compensate for that damage.
Yeah. And along the lines of resilience, you know, with people with mild cognitive impairment or like early dementia, why is resilience like a really important attribute to have?
I mean, you can think about psychological resilience, right? That even though you've been given a diagnosis or you know there's something going wrong, that rather than hiding the diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment or dementia, particularly people with dementia feel ashamed and then they stop doing things, kind of keeping going with life, so staying socially active, mentally active, physically active, they can be protective, you know, and kind of help you maintain, I guess, your well-being. So that's psychological resilience. But I guess if you think of brain resilience, then those are things that you've kind of built in your brain through life. So we know that if you work in a mentally difficult, complex job, right, that you are more resilient. So even if you have a certain amount of brain damage, like your memory tests are not as bad because you've kind of built up maybe increased networks in your brain. So you can think of brain resilience as well. And we call it cognitive reserve sometimes. If you have a higher level of education, again, you know, that's protective against kind of showing symptoms of dementia with a certain level of brain damage.
Yeah, for sure. And there are obviously probably a lot of technological advancements that have contributed to being able to diagnose, you know, early signs of this. So do you think that there are like more innovations that can help contribute to sort of these diagnoses?
I mean, part of the challenge in diagnosing mild cognitive impairment, like I said, was that you officially, if you were used official diagnostic criteria, you need a neuropsychological test. And psychologists using those tests would say, well, I don't know what the baseline is. I don't know where the person was to start with. So how do I know how much they've got worse? If that makes sense. I think with apps in particular, we're going to see people kind of tracking their own memory and thinking. And so they'll be able to find their own decline. And we're seeing a few of these kind of brain training apps and stuff as well, where people with dementia and mild cognitive impairment are kind of practicing those cognitive skills they have trouble with. So, for example, if they have trouble with names, they might be practicing, practicing names. If they're having trouble with planning, they might be playing games that help them plan. So I think that, you know, there is starting to be more and more evidence about that brain training apps can help with that specific cognitive function. Does that make sense? Even though they don't generalize. So if you practice memory training, then that doesn't help you with planning. You have to practice planning if you want to improve on planning.
Yeah, that's really interesting because we're obviously talking about resilience as well. And I guess these apps are showing signs of, you know, self-resilience and sort of doing things that help you improve and help you sort of push through, you know, having received this diagnosis as well. So I think that's a really interesting development.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, and I'd love to talk about some of the misconceptions that might exist about mild cognitive impairment and dementia. Do you think that there are any prominent ones that exist?
Let me talk about dementia first, perhaps. So the question that a lot of people will ask us is, what's the difference between Alzheimer's disease and dementia?
Yeah.
Which isn't a myth, but it's like a misunderstanding. And the answer is that Alzheimer's disease is a type of dementia, and dementia is the umbrella term for neurocognitive disorders, Alzheimer's disease being the most common type, but you could have vascular dementia, frontotemporal dementia, Lewy body dementia, and they all sit under that umbrella term dementia.
Okay.
So that's the first myth. The second myth about dementia is that dementia only happens to older people. So people who are younger can only get dementia. Of course, it's much less common, but, you know, a small proportion of people with dementia are young, you know, you have dementia before the age of 65, and some of them get it much younger. They're even very rare childhood dementias. So I guess that's the second myth about dementia as well.
Yeah, and just in terms of, like, young people getting dementia, what are, like, the contributing factors to that?
I mean, there are some very rare kind of genetic dementias. So they're caused by a certain gene. And so hereditary dementias, they run like in the family. So if you have the gene, you're going to get the dementia. Those people tend to get them younger. But other people who get dementia young, I mean, we don't really know why they get them younger, because the risk factors for younger onset dementia are very similar to the risk factors for late onset dementia. So, you know, heart health, lifestyles we've talked about, some less well-known risk factors are things like hearing, you know, your education. Like they're the same risk factors. So we don't know why some people get it younger and some people get it older.
Okay, and do you think that through, like, further developments and further research that this is something people are, like, trying to get a better understanding of?
Yeah, of course, yeah. So there's a few epidemiological studies looking at young cohorts of young people of younger onset and comparing them to, you know, later onset, trying to figure out why their dementia emerged earlier.
Yeah, amazing. Well, thank you for sharing some of those with us and also, like, clarifying the difference between, like, Alzheimer's and dementia as well. I'd love to ask if there are any sort of strategies that exist for providing more, like, holistic care that addresses not only, like, cognitive aspects but also sort of the emotional side of things, because obviously there's the mental side of things and what's happening on the inside, but then there's also, like, how we're feeling or how someone's, you know, managing, you know, their diagnosis?
That's such a great question, because when we think about dementia, we think about memory and thinking difficulties.
Yeah.
But if you talk to someone, when we talk to people with dementia, it's actually not the memory or thinking that bothers them. It's either their ability to not be able to do things or kind of the social loss because their friends fall away or, you know, they're not invited to things or they can't, you know, get out and do the things that they love anymore. Yeah. So in terms of holistic care, the focus can't be on memory and thinking alone, right? It has to be on helping that person do the things that are meaningful to them in life, which might mean cooking, or it might be gardening, or it might be playing golf, or it might be doing the flowers for church. And because our health system is very medically oriented, there's, I guess, less supports and structures to help people with that. But for example, occupational therapists are very good at helping people with dementia and their families kind of support them to do things that are still meaningful to them in life.
Yeah, and what other kind of support systems do you think should be in place to help people, you know, struggling with not just the memory loss side of things, but also the loss of, you know, their ability to do just normal everyday things?
We know that for some people, they really appreciate peer support groups or activity groups with other people with dementia and carers. So
yeah.
they might find it harder or more embarrassing to play golf with their old golf friends, or maybe the girlfriends don't want them anymore, but they can still do the activity within a peer support group where no one's going to laugh at them if, you know, they can't make the score and stuff. So I think that having for some people, not everyone wants to do that, but some people that really makes a difference. I think the other thing is that we really need to train aged care providers better to support people. So people with dementia often qualify for home care, and sometimes they ended up in residential care or in nursing homes. And so having those staff really understand how to support the emotional well-being, as you've got in your mission, of people with dementia is really critical then, because it's not really about reminding them to take their tablets, though that's part of the job. It's helping them be able to paint a picture or sing a song or, you know, walk, you know, pat a dog, because those are the things that are important to them.
Yeah, and how should we as a society help, you know, better prepare and support people with, you know, for example, mild cognitive impairment or dementia?
Well, that's why I'm so grateful, I think, for you doing a podcast like this, because I don't think that people really want to talk about dementia. But when I tell people, oh, I do research in dementia, we make information for people with dementia, so many people have a story, an auntie, yeah, a grandmother, you know, with dementia, and then they will ask questions. And I always think, well, you only talk to me about it because I said I'm interested in dementia, but we don't talk about it with our peers or our friends. We might talk about hair and makeup or movies and books or, you know, reality television shows, but we're much less like, oh, you know, I don't know, people talk about what they did at the gym, you know, or what they did on the weekend, but we're much less likely to, I guess, think about how in our lives, and the people with mild cognitive impairment or dementia in our lives, probably almost everyone knows someone with dementia in their family, like how they support them and kind of keep them included in family life.
Yeah, for sure. And I feel like that's a really important point as well, because we often forget about how important it is to support other people and have these conversations. Because like you said, we'll talk about the gym or we'll talk about movies or these really comfortable topics that are just easy to talk about. But then we avoid things like this because they're a lot deeper and they're a lot more emotional and they're heavier things to talk about, which can, you know, bring on some discomfort. So I think maybe it's also about finding ways to have these conversations in a comfortable manner, like how we are now. Like it's just a normal conversation, but it is about something a bit more serious.
Yeah. So at the moment, we're running a campaign called Face Dementia, where we're giving information, giving information about what the early signs of dementia could be. The website is facedementia.au. If people are interested. But what's really interesting is that as we go about in the community, people are telling us that they don't know how to talk to their family member who they're worried about might have dementia. They're worried that that person will be angry or upset or denial or be like, there's nothing wrong with me. And so I think that if people were less afraid of talking about dementia, then perhaps it would be more comfortable to say, oh, mum, you know, I'm just a bit worried that you're having trouble managing the you know, paying the bills, you know, should we go to the doctor and see if there's something that can be done, get a checkup? I think it's really hard for people to have that conversation.
Yeah, for sure. And do you think it's important for families to be able to openly talk about that? And where do you think that sort of like fear stems from?
Yeah, for sure we want families to talk about that. We know that families are the people most likely to initiate help seeking for dementia. And I think the fear stems from this myth that nothing can be done if you have dementia, which isn't true. I mean, there's treatments, there's medications which can help a bit, but there's rehabilitation, there's services to help you. It's way better to know what's going on for yourself and the family. So I think the fear comes from this idea that if you have dementia, that you'll go into a nursing home, that they'll take your driver's license away, that, you know, it means that you're going to lose everything, your independence. And what I've been saying is, if you have dementia, you already have dementia. The doctor doesn't give you dementia. The doctor is like, does that make sense? People don't want to go to the doctor because they might tell them you've got dementia. I was like, no, the doctor doesn't give you dementia. The doctor's kind of like opening the door to medications and services and supports and information. And really, you should go and ask your doctor if you're concerned, because the symptoms that you're experiencing might not be dementia at all. It might be something completely reversible and treatable, like depression or, you know, a thyroid kind of, you know, disorder. And so you should really go and talk to your doctor if you're concerned, and you should kind of nudge your family member if you're worried about them.
Yeah, I feel like that's a really good point as well, because often even with things like outside of dementia, like we think we might have something and we avoid going to the doctor because we're like in denial about that certain thing. And we think if we go to the doctor, then we suddenly have this thing, but we've already got it. Like no one's giving it to us. It's just about confirming that we have it and something can be done. And, you know, it's a different path forward now as opposed to just being totally in the dark.
Absolutely. 100% agree with you. And if you're worried about dementia or something else, the doctor doesn't give you, you know, the disease, you should just go and get it checked out.
Yeah, perfect disclaimer. I love that. Beautiful. I think we can move into our practices and habit debrief section. So here we're just going to ask you about sort of your personal application to things. So is there like a practice that you personally recommend to help deal with neurocognitive disorders?
Do you mean risk reduction, or do you mean if I was supporting someone with dementia?
Let's go with if you were supporting someone with dementia.
Okay. If I was supporting someone with dementia, the first thing that I try and do is understand that person. So rather than making assumptions about what they can do or what they can't do, you know, trying to read them, work with them, and understand, I guess, and support them to do as much as they can, which is really tricky because some people with dementia can pretty much manage their everyday life, and some people with dementia might present really well, but, you know, couldn't find the bathroom or, you know, make a sandwich or go to the toilet independently. So I think if I was supporting someone with dementia, it's really about personalizing my interactions with them to support them to do as much as they can and feel as good and confident about themselves as they can.
Yeah, for sure. And is there like a specific way this can be practiced, or maybe like a set of different things that can be applied to help someone when they're going through dementia?
The general principle is, if I was looking after someone with dementia, if they couldn't tell me what help they needed, then to get like, you know, an informant, like a carer or someone else to give me some information about what that person likes, what they dislike, what might upset them, you know, and how to best support them. Because it's really hard to know that when you meet someone, they can't tell them that yourself. So essentially, I get a history or, you know, some information from someone who knows them well if they can't tell me.
Yeah, and just along the lines of like hardships and challenges, obviously there's the one that's happening for the person that actually has the dementia, but also what are some of the other challenges when you're trying to help them build their confidence through this and sort of help them, you know, see out this sort of a new sort of stage in their life?
You have to be really, really patient when you work with people with dementia. And you have to put yourself in their shoes, if that makes sense. So people with dementia might ask you the same question 20 times. And the reason they're asking you that is because they can't remember. It's not to annoy you. So you can't snap at them at the third or fourth time. You have to answer it again. Or if you can figure out a strategy of giving them that information, like writing it down or, you know, giving them a watch or a calendar or somewhere where they can look it up themselves because they're asking about the day of the date or when's my daughter coming, then you do those things. So I think like really being patient and trying to, I know this sounds unusual, but like trying to keep the power so that the person has, you know, equal power to you. Because I think when you're working with people with dementia, especially those whose cognition is worse, it's very tempting to take the power in the social situation, meaning you become the boss, right? Like the teacher or the person in charge, and you just tell them what to do and you boss them around. And I think if we truly want to support the independence of those people, then you have to kind of stay humble and still give them respect and power within that social interaction.
Yeah, and do you think there's sort of a process of self-evaluation you should go through as the individual trying to help someone just to be like, okay, am I the right type of person to be patient enough to be able to support them in these ways? Do you think that's important to do?
I mean, self-reflection is important anyway, right? Like self-reflection is important just for us in everyday life. And I know some people aren't into it, but, you know, I feel like you should be self-reflective in your practice. And not everyone, I think, is necessarily the best people to look after some, you know, support people with dementia. But I think everyone can learn, you know, if they're prepared to kind of modify their natural behaviours.
Yeah, perfect. And how do you think this sort of practice, you know, helping someone with dementia, you know, improve their confidence and improve their approach to life can influence your own personal resilience?
I love working with older people with dementia. When you have time to hang out with them and, you know, be with them, they often have had incredible lives and they'll share these amazing stories. And often they have, you know, so much joy and fun in them. And it's just, I guess, finding a space for you to have that together. Does that make sense? Yeah. So I think it's really enriching working with people generally, you know, but particularly people with dementia where it might be, it's a challenge, I guess. It's a bit harder to find those points of connection than you can with your girlfriend who you know very well, you know, and just like slipping on old shoes. Whereas when you're working with people with dementia, particularly ones who, you know, you've met for the first time, then you're trying to find like that point of connection together, and it's very satisfying when you can do it.
Yeah, perfect. Well, I think that's a lovely point to leave off that section and jump into our questions from the audience now. So I think we've answered quite a few of them during our conversation today, but I feel like there's a couple points we haven't touched on yet. And one of them is, can specific cognitive exercises help individuals slow down the progression of MCI?
I think we talked about it a little bit in that I mentioned that when you're brain training, if you train your memory, then your memory might improve, but it doesn't improve your planning. And so if you want to slow down progression of MCI, you should, I guess, have a broad range of brain stimulating activities, which might include training certain aspects of memory and thinking, but also includes socializing. You know, we're doing a trial at the moment called Neuromusic, where we're looking at whether learning an instrument or singing in a choir, you know, can kind of improve or maintain your cognition and your brain well-being. So I think that kind of doing cognitively difficult things and a range of those things is probably what's going to help you with mild cognitive impairment.
Yeah, and are there sort of specific exercises that can be applied broadly, or is it more situational depending on the individual and, you know, how their dementia or, you know, their diagnosis is?
I mean, it probably depends on the person, and I probably am not allowed to recommend any particular apps, but there's plenty out there if you look for them, yeah.
Yeah, amazing. And my next one for you is, are there specific risk factors that increase the likelihood of developing mild cognitive impairment, or any lifestyle choices that, you know, help like reduce these risks?
Yeah, so the risk factors for mild cognitive impairment and dementia pretty much overlap, and they are around physical health, so heart health, so looking after your blood pressure, keeping it low, making sure your cholesterol's, you know, in check, looking after your weight, not smoking, they're all risk factors. Then there's, you know, the lifestyle things like staying physically active, staying cognitively active, staying socially active. We know that hearing, like having bad hearing, increases your risk of dementia. And there's some other ones like environmental air quality, stuff maybe that's harder for you to do something about. We also know that education is protective against dementia, though it seems very extreme, I think, for people to do more education later in life. But certainly, you know, staying cognitively active and, you know, doing further education and stuff like that is protective.
Yeah. And for my next one, we've talked about, you know, strategies that, you know, caregivers can use, you know, for example, to help build confidence within people with, you know, some of these diagnoses. But are there any strategies they can use themselves, you know, when they're going through the process of giving care towards someone that's got MCI or dementia?
I mean, in kind of the dementia, clinicians will say you've got to remember there's two patients, the patient with dementia and there's the carer and, you know, potentially extended family, and we need to support the carer as well. For carers, getting educated is good. Getting a support network, whether it's, you know, their personal network, like someone they can talk to and vent to, or a carer support group is really helpful. And also respite. So respite is funding that the government has so that carers can get a break. So the person that they look after might go on a bus for an activity, or might even stay overnight somewhere, so the carer can really have a break and recharge their batteries.
Yeah, I feel like those are some great ones. And I feel like I love how you mentioned that there are two patients in this, you know, the carer and the person with the actual, you know, diagnosis. So that's a really important point. So thank you for mentioning that. I think we can get into our last section for today, which is our open mic. So here we just like to open the floor to our guests to talk about anything that they would like. It could be a continuation from what we've discussed today, or it could just be the most random topic that you would like. So the floor is yours.
I mean, seeing we're talking about mild cognitive impairment and dementia, maybe I could ask you, do you have someone in your family, you know, and what's your experience been like personally around these topics?
I love the flipping of like the table or whatever that saying is. But actually recently, so my great uncle passed away this week and he had dementia. So just obviously wasn't super close to him, unfortunately, but I did see the impact it had on, you know, the people around him that were his direct like caregivers. And it's something that takes up a lot of your time, and it becomes, you know, something that affects your entire family, because I wasn't always around him, I would always hear about, you know, the difficulties that they would go through, because while their like memory is degenerating, it's sort of taking a lot from, you know, the people around them who are caring for them, because it's like you're watching someone, you know, slowly lose themselves, and there's nothing you can really do about it. You just sort of have to sit there. And unfortunately he did pass away, so they sort of saw that through till the end. So it's a very interesting process to see how it affects, like you said, the first patient and also the second patient as well.
Yeah, I'm sorry that you lost someone. And I think that, I mean, your story is so common, right? It's not just that person, it's the whole family. And it becomes the whole topic of conversation and stuff. And I do wish that, so thank you for sharing that. And I do wish that, I guess, we can, you know, that more people would talk at work or at the pub about this, because maybe then we could be sharing tips and supporting each other as well. Yeah. So if there was anything I was passionate about to say, I think it would be to say, I've learned in this job, I've met people with dementia, they've become my friends, and they change from being participants to be studied to real people like who have taught me things in my life. And I think that we have to stop othering people with dementia. Like, like the way that before people with mental illness were like over there, but now we're like, okay, well, mental illness is really common and I have friends with, ADHD or depression, and that they're part of my in-group. And I think we need to start to, in society, think of people with dementia as being like part of us, if that makes sense, and to keep treating them as part of us rather than like them over there who are old and in nursing homes. And we'll just try and avoid getting there because, there's a chance that if we live long enough, like if we live to over 90, the one in three of us will get dementia. We're all living longer. So my call to action, I suppose, is, if you have someone with dementia in your life, then reach out to them or, next time you have an opportunity to just like do something with them that might add value to their lives, but also to your life.
Yeah, 100%. And I feel like it's so important not to make them feel isolated, because they probably feel isolated enough going through something that, maybe no one else around them is. Their caregivers obviously don't have dementia or have a diagnosis. So it's very hard to feel like you're, supported when you're the only one going through it, especially if you're forgetting things as well. So it's important along the lines of not othering people to make them feel like they're still included as part of, the same family that, they were born into, and, just not making them feel excluded from things just because they're going through something you might not be able to understand.
Absolutely. Thank you for saying that so nicely.
That's okay. I try. Sometimes I stumble, but that was great. Thank you so much for sharing that with us and also giving me an opportunity to talk about my experience. I've never had that on the show yet, so that was really great. So thank you for that. And that also brings us to the end of today's episode. So I just wanted to say another thank you for coming on and just being so open and, willing to talk about this, because as we said, it's something that doesn't get talked about enough. And we were able to talk about a couple myths, ways that not only patient one, but also like patient two can go through this process. So I feel like we've opened the door a lot for, different ways people can talk about this. So thank you for that.
No, thanks for having me and thanks for having the conversation. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, of course, me too. Well, for those of us watching who want to find out a bit more about you and what you do, where can we go?
For information about dementia, you can go to facedementia.au, or for more information about dementia, you can go to forwardofdementia.au, and you can Google me and find me on the University of Sydney website otherwise.
Beautiful. Well, we also have Lee Fay's information down in the description below. But to everyone watching, thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.
You have been listening to Bouncing Back, the Personal Resilience Science Insights podcast produced by the Life Management Science Labs. Listen to episodes from LMSL's 10 Life Management Perspectives on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or other podcasting apps on your smartphone. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider rating our show, sharing it, and subscribing to our channel, as it helps other people find it and us grow to bring you more quality resources. More of our work can be found on our website, pr.lmsl.net, where you can join our movement. I'm Joanna. Thanks for tuning in.